This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a big personality show today, and no, I'm not talking about myself as usual. We're going to line up the big personalities who voters may have lined up for our consideration beyond today's election results. We're also going to explore the tension between the doctrine of separation of church and state and contemplated bans on praying at public meetings. Does religious tolerance in America imply that banning prayer might actually infringe on someone's rights? It's a complicated question before the U.S. Supreme Court. Plus, the financial froth of Twitter going public this week and the tangible tech over at Chrysler. Are retooled manufacturing companies the better high-tech investment? And we note that Detroiters have retooled City Hall, electing Mike Duggan, who happens to be the first white mayor of Detroit since 1974. Duggan is one of the personalities who thanked voters last night and jumped right into our front row consideration as possible national figures. Fresh political faces, tested political faces. There's also Democrat Terry McAuliffe, governor of Virginia, winning in a squeaker over his Republican rival. Republican Chris Christie, reelected governor of New Jersey by a huge margin. A progressive Democratic mayor in the city of New York, Bill de Blasio, for the first time in 20 years. And add to those names, New Jersey's newest senator who won in a special election in October, Democrat Cory Booker. And don't forget outgoing New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who is without a gig right now and undoubtedly making plans for something. WNYC reporter Anna Sale is with us. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks.
Also, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
Let's start with Terry McAuliffe. Is he too beat up after this campaign to be a national figure, or does he jump right into the front row?
Well, I don't think he jumps into a front row as a national politician. Terry McAuliffe's bailiwick was always fundraising, and we'll see how he can do as a policymaker because he's never done it before. But you're right, it was kind of a squeaker, 48% for McAuliffe, 45.5% for Ken Cuccinelli, the conservative attorney general of Virginia. Another guy, independent Robert Sarvis, got 6.6%. Now, the autopsy, the blame. Everybody seems to be taking the message from this race that they want to take. The Democrats say, hey, Republicans, the government shutdown killed you. Hey, we won Virginia for the third time in a row after Barack Obama won it twice. And it just proves, Republicans, you're at war with yourselves because you picked somebody too conservative, and we're going to keep beating you. Over in Republican land, John, the second-day story for them is taking the message that you want to take. The Tea Party folks, the conservatives who backed Ken Cuccinelli, say if the Republican establishment had gotten behind us, we would have won. The RNC spent $9 million in 2009. This time they spent a third of that. We would have won. If Bobby Jindal, who the governor of Louisiana, who's in charge of the National Governors Association, had done the right thing and put more money in, we would have won. If you hadn't abandoned us, we would have won. Chris Christie, we begged you to come and campaign for Ken Cuccinelli. You refused. If you had done it, we would have won. And the Republicans say, if you guys had nominated somebody more mainstream, this never would have happened. Everybody is taking the message that they want to hear. And what message have Republicans learned as they're at civil war with each other? John, it doesn't seem like they've really learned a salient message at all.
Well, they've certainly learned that the governor-elect in Virginia is Terry McAuliffe. Here he is speaking to supporters.
From Lee County to Virginia Beach to Winchester, thank you for what you did to help us get elected the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
A sense of relief there from Governor-elect Terry McAuliffe, Democrat from Virginia. But listen to Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of New York, speaking to his supporters Tuesday night.
That inequality, that feeling of a few doing very well, while so many slip further behind, that is the defining challenge of our times.
Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio talking about income inequality. WNYC reporter Anna Sale. Does Bill de Blasio inherit the mantle of Paul Wellstone as the progressive liberal on the national stage in the U.S.?
He's certainly embracing it. In his victory speech, he not only said that income inequality is the defining challenge of our time, he went on to say we must commit ourselves to progressive ideas that will lift us all. Bill de Blasio ran throughout this campaign as the most liberal in the field of the crowded Democratic primary going back several months. And then he won by almost 50 points over the Republican challenger. He talked about a tale of two cities. He talked about closing this income inequality gap. And that was also the way that he made his case that he would be different after 12 years of Mayor Michael
Very
Bloomberg.
Local issues in New York. It still remains to be seen how long the honeymoon will last. The big numbers, the really interesting numbers over in New Jersey. Here's Chris Christie getting reelected. Not a surprise, but there's some interesting stories in the numbers.
I know that tonight a dispirited America, angry with their dysfunctional government in Washington, looks to New Jersey to say, is what I think happening really happening? Are people really coming together?
Christie magic, Anna Sale?
You hear that there in that victory speech, speaking to Americans, not just New Jersey voters. But Chris Christie's victory was huge last night. I mean, 20 points over the Democratic challenger. And he won among Hispanic voters, according to exit polls. He won among women voters. He got 20% of black voters in New Jersey. So he had a great victory. But it's also important to point out that there was some political maneuvering that helped him get that victory. For example, Cory Booker opted not to run against Chris Christie. He's the Democratic star in New Jersey. And then not only didn't run against him for governor, then there was a special election for Senate, so Cory Booker wouldn't be on the same ballot as Chris Christie. So some help there in getting that big margin.
Cory Booker, someone to watch. Mayor Michael Bloomberg, outgoing, someone to watch. Todd, would you add or subtract anyone from our cast of personalities before we go?
There was a little race down in Alabama I want to bring you up to speed on in 10 seconds. It was the establishment versus the Tea Party. In a way, this race was a little bit different. A guy named Bradley Byrne, who had the backing of the Chamber of Commerce and the big Republican money, beat a fellow named Dean Young, who cast himself as sort of a Ted Cruz character. Bradley Byrne will be the next congressman from Mobile, Alabama, when he's reelected easily in January. That's a very red district down there.
Thanks for that. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and Anna Sale, reporter for WNYC. Big personalities in their own rights. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You bet.
Voters expressed some big personalities in the ballot measures passed and defeated yesterday. A label requirement on foods containing genetically modified organisms defeated in Washington state. But a tax on newly legalized marijuana passed in a big way in the state of Colorado. But for Coloradoans, a $1 billion tax increase to overhaul that state's education system defeated. New Jersey voters raised the minimum wage over the objections of their popular governor. To talk about all of this, Wendy Underhill joins us, program manager at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Wendy, welcome.
Glad to be here with you. Thank you, John.
What do you think was expressed by voters? Is it all very, very local in these ballot measures?
You're absolutely right that it is local. Each of the initiatives faced in the six states that had statewide ballot initiatives was unique to its state. But for me, John, the most surprising thing was that we had 28 yes votes out of 31 ballot measures that were voted on, and that's a pretty high pass rate.
Now, normally you wouldn't expect Coloradoans to want to raise taxes, but in this case, the cost of regulating legalized marijuana is really perceived as a cost that taxpayers don't want to pay for. They'd rather have the pot smokers pay for it.
I think you could call it a sin tax, and we've had them on other things as well. Here in Colorado, where the National Conference of State Legislatures is headquartered, we put 25% tax on marijuana, which will become legal to sell come January 1st, 2014. This is recreational marijuana. I want to be sure people understand, not medical marijuana.
Understood. Yeah. Understood. Mm-hmm. The education, though, levies had much more difficulty. People don't want to pay for government in general. Sin taxes are one thing, but paying for infrastructure, that's something else.
In Colorado, the major measure that you mentioned that would have funded schools was $950 million, and it did fail. But it's unclear whether it failed because voters didn't want to pay that tax or because of the changing in the funding structure behind it. So as the day wears on, there may be more information on what made voters say no to that measure here in Colorado.
I'm really interested in the Washington state vote on GMO labeling. And really what you have there is a template for an industry initiative to try to defeat something that's going to come up in other states, wouldn't you say?
It came up last year in 2012 in California. A similar measure was on the ballots there and was defeated. So that's twice now it's gotten on the ballots and twice it's been defeated. What proponents will do in the future, those who want to see labeling, is unclear to me at this point. I do think one of their options would be to go to state legislatures and ask for measures to be passed that way rather than going on statewide ballots, possibly.
But the ballot measure strategy is going to come with a major, headwind of outstate funding, out-of-state funding, and advertising to try to get these things defeated. That much we certainly learned in Washington State.
It is true that a lot of out-of-state money was involved in that race in Washington, yes.
What do you make of New Jersey citizens raising the minimum wage basically by changing their own constitution?
It was not that surprising to us. 18 states already have a minimum wage that's higher than the federal minimum wage, and New Jersey became the fifth state to put that into their constitution. So, yes, it's unusual, but it's not very unusual. It did also not only increase it from $7.25 to $8.25 per hour right now, but it also includes an index for future inflation as well.
What do you make of the ballot measure process in general over the many, many years since, it became very, very popular in tax policy in California back in the, 1970s and 1980s? It has both encouraged legislatures to take on issues they might not have taken on and also complicated the political process in enormous ways. Where do you think it stands right now?
Of the measures that are on the ballots this year, most of them were put there by state legislatures. So I just want to make the distinction between a legislative referral and a citizen initiative. And I think you're talking about the citizen initiative process where people gather signatures to put a measure on the ballot.
And ballot measures are becoming much more integrated with the legislature, attempting to figure out if voters want something before maybe they take up the matter on their own.
Yes, there are at least two ways that a measure could come to the attention of the legislature or the population, and one is through legislation and the other is through the ballot initiative process. We certainly are seeing in the 24 states that offer citizen initiatives, we are seeing a continued and possibly increasing number of ballot measures that get on through that citizen process.
Do these work better in off-off year elections, or is it better to have a national candidate or a statewide race, a congressional race to bring people to the polls?
Ballot measures do tend to go on the even year ballots. And in 2012, for instance, 174 ballot measures were on statewide ballots, and 2013, only 31. So the system is definitely weighted towards getting these kinds of initiatives onto even year ballots.
Wendy Underhill, Program Manager at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Thanks so much, Wendy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I can't imagine anything more precious than a story like this.
This is Katie from Little Rock, Arkansas. I spent many summers with my grandparents Eisenhower at their home just a few blocks from the shore in Wildwood, New Jersey. In the evenings, Nana and I would sit on the porch where she would cuddle me. We would look at the stars, and she would call me her little lamb.
Katie's memory of her Nana there from Arkansas. You got a cherished memory. We're going to have a discussion of where memory lives in the brain later this hour. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at Facebook.com/The Takeaway. Don't forget now. So for all of the revolutionary ideas in the U.S. Constitution regarding separation of church and state and the idea that there would be no official state religion, there have always been more than a few just-in-case, apparently, invocations of God and prayer in U.S. civic life. The House and Senate saw a need to have an official chaplain around in 1789, and both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison strongly objected. But In God We Trust is on all of our money. Candidates talk about God all the time in modern politics.
Our founding fathers believed in the right for us to pray and have that freedom of expression in prayer. And that's what we offer here today in 2013 in the town of Greece.
Today, the Supreme Court will consider the issue of religion in U.S. civic life in the case of Town of Greece versus Galloway. That was John Auberger, Greece's board supervisor, speaking to PBS earlier this year. The issue before the court, is it unconstitutional for the town in upstate New York to open its meetings with prayer? A federal district court has ruled for the town to continue the practice. The Second Circuit ruled for the plaintiff, Susan Galloway, speaking here to NPR, about how the prayers make her feel.
Sometimes you don't feel very welcome. I don't feel like I'm welcome at my town government anymore. My father had to leave Germany because of Hitler. We have to stand up and make sure that our government and religion are separate because we are a diverse country.
What is the issue before the Supreme Court? We turn to Sarah Beringer Gordon, professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is the court really going to take up the Establishment Clause here, or is it a mix of Establishment Clause and an argument that somehow free speech is infringed if there's a ban on praying?
Well, it's a very complicated set of questions, and there's a big precedent from the Supreme Court from 30 years ago that tried to answer all of the questions about whether we should allow invocations at the outset of important meetings of legislatures or town councils like Greece's, but left open a number of questions. And there's been substantial developments since then. And the Supreme Court, we hope, will clarify the issues after this case.
Politically, a lot of conservatives have reframed the question of prayer bans or, you know, Christmas displays, et cetera, as not a church and state issue, but as a free speech issue, and that it is an expression of religious intolerance to control the public space. Does the Supreme Court show any evidence of buying that argument at all?
There is some evidence. I think there's, for example, just to give you a sense of how active that kind of argument is, several of the preachers who delivered invocations, who started the Greece town council meetings with prayer, have filed a brief arguing that their freedom of speech is at issue. Mm. So partly there's a desire to allow all kinds of expression, not just religious expression, but other forms as well. And screening out only religion would indeed be a problem.
Will the argument today be, and might the court decide to create a formula whereby you have to have an equal representation of all religions, including non-religion invocations, that sort of thing?
Well, that raises the question of the practice of the town of Greece, which you mentioned, for example, that the first federal Congress hired a chaplain. Greece, in fact, did not open its meetings with prayers until 1999. So we have not a sort of age-old practice here. We have a new one. And for the first 9 years until this lawsuit was filed, every prayer was delivered by a Christian and was often explicitly Christian. After the lawsuit was filed, the town council invited a Wiccan priestess and a Jewish layman to deliver the invocations, but very quickly reverted to an overwhelmingly Christian message, often delivered in explicitly Christian terms. So part of what we have here is a particular set of practices by the town that not only didn't include all religions, but only really included one for a substantial portion of the practice. Thus, you heard the Jewish plaintiff saying that her faith was explicitly excluded by the town council. Mm-hmm.
You know, for a bunch of Unitarians and revolutionaries who wrote the Constitution and started the American Revolution, I'm surprised at how many biblical and religious references remain in our civic life. Is this a leftover debate between the Puritans and the anarchists?
Oh, that's a great question. I do think that, for example, sometimes we toss around low-level religious words. We call ice cream sin, or we invoke one or another name for God when we're just talking. So it's impossible to get rid of religious allegory and language entirely. I also think, though, that that it would be an impoverished world if it was just secular voices, secular occurrences, and so on, that the strength of religious commitment and the great variety and creativity in this country of religious belief and expression is what we want to nurture, not silence.
And that will certainly be before the court today. And you'll probably hear some impassioned questions with arguments implied from some of the justices as well. Sarah Beringer Gordon, professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mike Duggan got the call from voters in Detroit last night to be the mayor of the troubled city.
The vast majority of people in this city want the politics of us versus them divisiveness behind us. And now we're going to rebuild this city with the talents of everyone.
You can hear it in his voice. He's got his work cut out for him. Who would want this job? A state-appointed emergency manager has been running the day-to-day operations of Detroit since it declared bankruptcy. Aside from ribbon cuttings and going to luncheons at the Garden Club, what can a mere mayor do in the city right now? Quinn Kleinfelder is reporter for WDET. Duggan is apparently thrilled to nab the worst job in the universe, Quinn.
In many respects, that's kind of true. You know, there's a lot of talk that there may not be the emergency manager for that long a period of time. He had an 18-month window that he was supposed to be operating. One of the reasons that they've pushed the city so quickly into a bankruptcy filing situation. And then the mayor and city council, under law, can vote him out, which everyone, including the emergency manager, believes would be the case. So it's a 4-year mayoral term, at least 3 of those. The mayor may have some form of control. On the other hand, there's a emergency financial review board that the state has put in place that could stay there long after the emergency manager. So, yeah, you know, it's very possible that the mayor and the city council of Detroit are going to have little say over the finances of the city for any time in the future.
Mike Duggan, first white mayor of the city of Detroit since 1974. Was he a minority candidate?
And yeah, actually, in the primary race, he was. And it was somebody that it seemed to go beyond race in this case. When you would go out and talk to people on the streets, a lot of times they would say, you know, it's not black, it's not white, it's green. We need money. The city is flat broke, facing $18 billion at least in long-term debt. And Duggan has had a reputation as being able to turn around companies. He was the former CEO of the Detroit Medical Center, which is a chain of hospitals that was doing pretty poorly until Duggan took it over. And he touted that, that he was able to turn around situations. And so that seemed to play with people. I spoke, for instance, with a person named Sterling Turner, who's one of Duggan's supporters. And he says the turnaround experience was paramount over any other aspect.
Doesn't matter if the man is white, black, orange, or yellow. We need somebody who's going to come in our city, who's going to lead our city. And not only just him as a leader, us as our residents, taking care of our neighborhoods when we do have houses built, try to talk to these gang members about trying to form a gang truce. So no matter what he's going to do, what his plan is, he can't do it on his own. It's going to take us as a city.
And Duggan does have a plan. He says he thinks he can talk the governor of Michigan to try to get out of the emergency manager situation much more quickly than is anticipated.
Well, he has the job. He has a plan. Is there a city mandate, a real consensus about moving forward, or do we get back into the divisive politics that really have characterized the last decade?
The divisiveness is still there. There has often been the use of trying to say that Detroit, which is like 85% African-American, doesn't want any interlopers coming in. Sometimes that's been a code word for race. Sometimes it's been a code word for the suburbs or a code word for anybody that's not from Detroit. So that has always been an issue that's come up at times. But in the moment now, it is a little bit different. In fact, there's almost a sense of ennui, if you want to put it that way, among many of the voters. They, as you stated right off the bat, realized very strongly that the mayor and the city council really don't have a whole heck of a lot of authority right now. And the turnout kind of reflected that. It was a fairly anemic turnout, about 25% of the eligible voters. A few years back, Kwame Kilpatrick was in the midst of scandal. There was about a 22% turnout then. But typically, it's been, you know, mid-30s, 37, 40% turnout. And this race was far from that.
A wait-and-see attitude there on the part of voters who didn't turn out in droves. But Mike Duggan is the mayor of Detroit. Quinn Kleinfelder, reporter for WDET in Detroit. Thanks, Quinn.
Thank you, John.
One more thought about the idea of Detroit, if not the city. Once Detroit was the high-tech capital of the world when the auto industry was in its infancy. And this year, as investors drool over or seem skeptical of the impending Twitter initial public offering, the IPO of Chrysler may be a more important indicator of where high-tech matters most. Twitter makes no money, a detail, right, in the social media domain, but Chrysler's third quarter earnings climbed 22% year-to-year, solidly profitable company. It actually sells something. Michelle Krebs joins us, senior analyst for Edmunds.com, a car shopping website. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So on the Chrysler IPO, is this a referendum on Chrysler's manufacturing prowess in a high-tech world, or is it a bit of a financial transaction for Fiat, a little game playing here?
Well, it's both, because Chrysler went through bankruptcy 5 years ago, came out with Fiat owning a piece of it, and Fiat's been buying more and more, and the ultimate game plan is to merge Fiat and Chrysler into this big global company that will use economies of scale to do manufacturing, high tech, do all kinds of development work that them on their own can't really do.
So the consolidation of Fiat and Chrysler, and the IPO would be the beginning of this, is really a high tech startup.
Well, I guess you could see it that way. I certainly believe that the auto industry, auto manufacturing, is a very high-tech industry. I rankle when people call it a Rust Belt industry.
And in terms of pricing, what do we think Chrysler's shares are going to be worth now that it's emerged from bankruptcy? And, you know, it's going to be a little while before we know that, but what's the buzz?
Well, we don't know yet, and it should be priced in December, but this is not a simple IPO. One of the main stumbling blocks is the fact that after bankruptcy, the union, UAW's trust that handles health care for retirees, received 41.5% of Chrysler. Fiat would like to buy that in a private sale before it goes to an IPO, but they have been wrangling on the price. They're billions of dollars apart on what that costs. So that is really creating a wrinkle in this whole process.
And the issue of obligations to employees and the union contracts, if you pull that away, is this IPO really a referendum on the importance of manufacturing in the U.S. as a jobs play compared with other sorts of sort of social media advertising driven kinds of startups like Twitter this week?
Well, I think so. You know, we saw General Motors go public again after going private after the bankruptcy. We've seen Tesla, the electric car maker, go public. Yeah, so this is about jobs. This is about high-tech cars of the future, because we're moving towards a time that there will actually be driverless cars. This is a very high-tech industry that creates a tremendous amount of jobs.
And the manufacturing technology advantage that a Chrysler might have over other companies in the world really, you know, fights the outsourcing trend that really has plagued the auto industry and U.S. manufacturing for years. Some people are saying there could be a turnaround and that Chrysler could be a part of it.
Well, right. I mean, the whole idea of the Fiat and Chrysler combination is that you will have this global footprint, this big company that can do a lot more together than individually. It is just really hard to make it on your own and being only in one country. As we can see with Fiat and Chrysler right now, it's interesting that, you know, Fiat bought into Chrysler to save it, and now it's Chrysler that's supporting Fiat because Fiat's struggling at home because of the European recession and the downturn in car sales. So that whole geographic footprint also helps balance things out when one place is doing poorly and another is doing well.
And that adorable little Fiat 500 fits nicely in the bed of a Dodge Ram pickup truck, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
There you go. Absolutely.
Michelle Krebs, senior analyst at Edmunds.com, a car shopping website. She's covered the automotive industry for over 30 years. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I think we can all agree that Chrysler's value is in its tangible manufacture of things, cars, machines. Twitter is more of a frothy whiff of something revolutionary. Twitter's value when it goes public this week is a huge puzzle. How it makes actual money is a huger puzzle. But Twitter's influence? Undeniable. Some might even say
priceless.
That's right. Priceless. Whatever Twitter's economic puzzles are, Twitter feeds and followers, Facebook friend lists, LinkedIn connection network, what comes up in a Bing, Yahoo, or Google search on us is a part of our value and identity, in theory and maybe even in terms of hard cash value. Josh Klein is the author of the new book, Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. Welcome, Josh.
Good to be here.
So what's in your wallet? A bunch of business cards, right? Forget money.
No, I keep that on my phone.
How do the values associated with who it is that we know and how our networks work translate into economic value, either now or in the near future?
Well, on the one hand, companies are getting better and better at quantifying all the aspects of our lives. So we know that they can track everything we do online, right? Google needs 22 points of data to identify you. Amazon prices things differently depending on what, you know, what area code you call in from. But at the same time, all those relationships have intangible value too.
And the closer someone gets to you, the more valuable my interactions with you become to you. And so in the way that this is quantifiable, all of a sudden it really just sort of throws up in the air the whole notion of what constitutes value. Your bank account has very little to do with all of this.
Well, right. You know, so for example, a few years ago, Microsoft filed a couple patents. One allowed them to put a number on your ability to influence others around a word or topic. So like if you had a blog about cheese, you could have a high number. On the other hand, the other patent allows them to dynamically price goods and services on same. So if you go online to buy cheese, Kraft can give you a big discount because you might say something nice about them. But if I only tweeted once about being lactose intolerant, they might price it so high I couldn't buy any at all.
Ah, because they think that you're negative.
Right.
They want to screen you out.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we're talking about what companies would do acting on this information, but how do we act on this information? The fact that it's quantifiable makes it – you know, part of our kind of digital memory. It's a sense of who we are that we carry with us.
Absolutely. And so this is one of the big points of my book, is that when you go to transact with someone, you're not just thinking about the dollars and cents that they represent, right? When you go to your mom's house and she gives you a cup of coffee and says, hey, my car won't start, would you take a look? You don't pull out a pad of paper and say, well, price of coffee, price of car repair. You don't calculate it out. Human beings don't work that way. And yet companies and corporations are constantly pushing us to.
And in the sense of your own personal network, how did you begin to calculate your own value, and how can you influence it by your behaviors on social media?
Well, what we've been hearing for the longest time is that the best way to cultivate a good network is to do good things for other people, be sincere, have valid relationships, you know, all the stuff.
Be sincere.
Yeah. Believe it or not.
So being sincere actually increases your value in a social network.
Well, it depends on your brand, obviously. But yeah, so the point to that is that a lot of the time people can tell if you're faking them, right? So on Facebook, one of my favorite pages is the condescending corporate brand page, where they just document all the social software campaigns which don't ring true.
And that has huge responses.
Oh, yeah. People are slagging them right and left.
And in terms of the way that we value ourselves, how is this different from, say, just a resume that you would go into a job interview with?
Well, right now you get a lot of different platforms that can substantiate you in ways you couldn't before. So, for example, Stack Overflow is a website where if you have a technical question, you can go and ask it. And people who have experience or can answer it, then answer it and then vote up the best response, right? Well, if I go in for a job interview – and my employer says, you know, hey, are you an expert in X, Y, or Z? He may not know what X, Y, or Z actually is, but he can go on Stack Overflow and see that a global community of my peers has said, yeah, he knows what he's talking about, or he doesn't.
So there's both a value to your identity on social media, and there's a validation ability that we didn't have before. So it's harder to BS people, although that's the opposite of what the intuition was when online networks began, that you could be anonymous, that you could actually adopt an identity that's fundamentally false. You say we're tipping in the other direction now.
Yes and no. I mean, you can have multiple identities, right? So you could go on Stack Overflow and answer it as DragonRider15 and get a great rep. And then when you go in for a job interview, you can cryptographically prove that you are DragonRider15, you know, which is great. But that doesn't mean your mom needs to know it.
Do you know someone named DragonRider15?
Yeah, I can't tell you that.
I can't tell you exactly. So if you referred earlier to you could do a blog on cheese, and if it demonstrated influence, it would basically increase your value to people who have a stake in the value of cheese. How is this different from, say, journalistic authority in the sense that the New York Times has a lot of authority? Are we basically micro-identifying ourselves as individual kind of journalists with brands like The Times and Newsweek or, you know, TMZ?
Well, so this is the big question of the day, right? It is – if I want to sell a lot of product on Amazon and I go to find some people who are big in the communities that use those products, can I then give them some products for free and have them endorse it? Well, yes, I can. But are you going to trust those people then?
The question is, you can really have a downside. The other question really is, can you increase your authority, thereby increase your value, and have some sort of specific monetary consequence as a result of that? Josh Klein, sounds like you already have had a monetary consequence. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Josh Klein is the author of Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. Next up on The Takeaway, the mysterious power and science of memory. What is most precious for you?
This is James Aldridge calling from Fort Lee, New Jersey. One of my most cherished memories is from a beautiful idyllic childhood that I spent growing up in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. In the winter, our mom would have made for us a hot drink, which typically was Dr. Pepper with lemon slices in it, heated slowly in a copper saucepan that she had just for that trick. And this is definitely one of my most cherished memories.
Nothing more precious than that. Concord, California, going to work with my dad on Saturday. It was a sheet metal shop, and for a little girl, it had the most awesome big machines. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the way you can call us with your story, with your cherished memories, much more at thetakeaway.org. You forget a name, say, one of the folks in your online network, and you can usually find it eventually, or just Google it, right? But where does the persistent memory of riding a bicycle reside inside us? Or something like playing an instrument, that deep physical collaboration between mind and muscle, or the physical skills required to draw or operate a complicated machine like a plane or a helicopter? Where does this memory live in our brains? Michael Leminick is a senior staff writer at Climate Central and a contributor to Time magazine, and he wrote a piece about this kind of memory published this week. It's a profile of Lonnie Sue Johnson, someone he actually went to high school with, whose tragic brain injury and memory loss has become an opportunity for some of the most exciting research on the deepest complexities in the brain. Leminick says his former classmate lost her memory suddenly, you might say, out of the blue.
She was working at her farm in upstate New York, and she was struck with viral encephalitis, an inflammation of the brain. Nobody knows how she got it. And a neighbor discovered her just sitting in her study, staring at the wall, and realized something was wrong and rushed her to the hospital. She almost died. She was in a coma. And by the time she came out of it, it was clear that her brain had been severely, severely damaged. And there's a structure or a pair of structures in the brain, one on each side, called the hippocampi. And these, we learned through studies of earlier victims of severe memory loss, is vital to the construction of new memories, the construction and storage of new memories. Hers was almost entirely wiped out, along with some surrounding structures that seem to play a part in memory formation as well.
And she comes after a character who is famous, of course, in brain research, a fellow whose acronym is HM, who had his hippocampus removed surgically as a way of dealing with epilepsy or seizure activity.
That's right. He had some memories of his past, of his history, especially of his youth. He had this surgery when I think he was about 27 years old, but he was unable to form new memories that were lastingly placed in his brain. So he could, if you had a conversation with him, he could continue the conversation because he could remember what you'd said 5 seconds ago. Mm. But if you went out of the room and came back in a few minutes later, he had no idea he'd ever met you before.
Do you know what you did yesterday?
No, I don't.
How about this morning?
That I don't know myself. I can't tell you because I don't remember.
My confusion about long-term and short-term memory is really, in a sense, something of a metaphor for just how rich the idea of memory is and how Lonnie Sue Johnson is going to add to that information by virtue of her experience, what it is she forgot. And it's a huge amount.
It's a huge amount. So first of all, she is very close to 100% incapable of forming new memories. So she's like HM in that way. If she meets you one day and you come back the next day, she'll have no idea who you are. If she's exposed to something repeatedly over and over and over again, she might begin to form a rudimentary memory of it. But essentially, she is living in a permanent present. She also, unlike H.M., she can remember almost nothing about her past. And if, you know, if ourselves, if who we are is really a combination of our experiences and our memories and all the life we've lived up until the present moment, it's very hard to imagine what that self is like or whether she has a self anymore.
And here's someone who was a skilled cartoonist for The New Yorker who was a pilot, a viola player.
Right. So the difference between Lonnie Sue Johnson, the current patient, and H.M. is that she was so deeply accomplished before her illness. H.M. was an assembly line worker, and he was not educated beyond high school. She had gone to college. She was a very successful commercial artist, a musician, a pilot. And all of these skills and previous talents are things that the scientists can now investigate.
One of the most amazing revelations in this piece that you write about and as part of this research, the Johnson research, is that she recognizes her own art.
That's right. She recognizes her own style.
And yet about other art, about other, you know, like a Picasso or something like that?
Yeah, she has a very difficult time identifying very celebrated works of art that she could have done in her sleep before the illness. So there's some difference and clearly – it must be because her art comes out of some deep place within her, whereas all the other art she had to observe and learn about.
And she remembers how to play music, right?
Yeah, she can still read music. She can still play the viola. She can't memorize new music. In fact, there's one test that they've performed on her where she's exposed to an entirely new piece of music and plays it on the viola, sight reads it on the viola haltingly, and they take it away and put it back a few minutes later. She's never seen it before as far as she knows. And the question is, will her playing improve as time goes on?
But it's also the question of in the muscles somewhere is stored something, in the muscles of her drawing, in the muscles of her viola playing.
You know, we talk about the fact that you can never forget how to ride a bicycle. And in fact, that's a profound comment because, as you say, we have memories in our muscles, procedural memories, memories of how to do things physically that we're not consciously aware of. That's a separate memory system. We learned that through HM, who learned new skills without realizing he was learning them.
Does Lonnie Sue Johnson possibly teach us that our memories are there in the brain? It is just the orchestration of organs like the hippocampus that retrieve them and process them, and so there may be hope for traumatic brain injury, that sort of thing?
Well, that's very preliminary because we understand so little still about how that works. But basically, you're right. They may be there somewhere, inaccessible, and you know, rebuilding your brain so you could access them is a bit science fiction-y at this point. But if they're there, that is a different situation than if they weren't.
You interacted with Lonnie Sue. I mean, as we're talking here, it sounds like her life is a little more than, you know, living in a cage and a guinea pig for brain doctors. But that's far from the case.
Oh, that's far from the case. So in her room, she has it decorated with all of her artwork and her books because she was a book illustrator. She's got it organized in a fantastically elaborate way. She spends her days mostly creating word puzzles because she became obsessed with words and the alphabet after her injury. She was never that way before. And she spends her days creating these word puzzles and decorating them. And it's really within her limitations, it's a very rich and seemingly a fulfilling life. She's very cheerful. She's very happy most of the time.
She certainly misses her old life.
She misses her old life. She does seem to remember that she flew a plane and loved to fly a plane. She seems to remember she owned a farm, and she misses it, whatever that means. But she doesn't obsess about it.
How excited are the scientists with the questions that Lonnie Sue Johnson may answer?
They are enormously excited because she's such a richly potentially informative patient. She's also a delight to work with. There's a lot of laughing that goes on at these sessions because she makes these silly puns and she delights in them so much you can't help laughing with her. She's a genuinely nice and affectionate person. So that's great. But they also really believe that they are going to answer questions they don't even know how to pose yet. As they go along in the research, things occur to them and they say, well, let's try this. Let's test this. Let's try and understand as much as we can about this still very complex brain that is somehow disconnected from its past and its future.
Michael Lemonick is senior staff writer at Climate Central and a contributor to Time magazine. His latest piece, The Muse of Memory, all about Lonnie Sue Johnson and the latest research on memories published this week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to WGBH Boston and the NOVA program for the sound of the research subject HM you heard in that interview. A different kind of memory is the focus for our Veterans Day presentation.
My name's Jason. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I was a medic in the Army, did a combat deployment with an infantry unit. You have to sit back, take a deep breath, and ease yourself back into civilian life.
Working with our friends at the Center for Investigative Reporting, we're collecting advice from veterans, for veterans, by veterans. We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag VetAdvice. Find us at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.